I'm speaking today with Damien LaCroix, who is running for State Senate District 15 in the Democratic primary. Damien, thank you for talking to me today. The first question I'd like to ask, why you're running for this office?
Well, I think it's quite evident. Senate District 15 lacks leadership. It lacks a senator who is engaged and active. And now's the time for the next generation to participate in shaping our future. So John Whitmire has been in office for 40 years. He has one district office in a district that spans all the way from the West Beltway to Baytown. He's not accessible to the constituents, and he's not active in the district. And he is without ideas. In my opinion, he focuses on two things, his seniority and criminal justice. And I believe that Senate District 15 is very diverse and that there are other issues that matter other than criminal justice. And I believe that there are more proactive ways in reforming the criminal justice system than what John Whitmire is doing. And in fact, when he took over the chairmanship in 1993, of the Criminal Justice Committee, there were only 64,000 people incarcerated. Because the laws he had written, and this is a fact, it increased it to 154,000. Okay? And so, the things that are important, I think, to reform the criminal justice system would be providing a 21st century education. As a product of a single mother, African-American, I have seen how a good education lifts people out of poverty and keeps them out of the criminal justice system. That's a proactive approach to me. Being more engaged, providing economic opportunities. I was talking to somebody the other day. There are people in Acres Homes who have the necessary training, education, qualifications, but can't seem to find a job. See, John Whitmire had a door open for him at 23, but everybody don't have those opportunities. And as a state senator, you have the ability to open up doors for folks who need a hand. And Senate District 15 is lacking that.
Okay, I'm going to come back to some of the points you've raised in a minute, but you ran for a judgeship in 2010. Tell me what you learned from that experience.
What I learned was that the voters make the ultimate decision in the outcome of the election. Doesn't matter who endorses you, doesn't matter what elected official is campaigning on your behalf, ultimately it's the voters that decide. And that was probably one of the most important things I've learned from that election.
Okay. Let's talk about education for a minute, since you emphasized that in your opening answer. As you know, in 2011, the Texas legislature cut $5.4 billion from public education. In 2013, they restored about two-thirds of that, so like $3.5 billion, something like that. There is still ongoing litigation regarding public education financing and what the proper level of it is and how we pay for it and all that. I want to know, what are your priorities? What specifically would you do to enhance, improve, alter public education, first of all from a financial perspective, and then in terms of what you would do in terms of curriculum and graduation requirements, since that was also a big deal in the last session?
So generally, Democrats and Republicans have two different philosophies on how they perceive public education and its importance. Because currently the state legislature is controlled by Republicans as well as the governorship, there may not be as much in terms of financing that can get done through the legislative process. But as a state senator, you're one of 31. So you have connections, you have influence to connect the federal government with local school districts, with the private companies that are on the sidelines willing to invest in schools that implement a science, technology, engineering, and math program, to connect the dots with nonprofits, with philanthropists. There's a gentleman out in the Independence Heights area. he lost a lot of his Title I funding. He didn't throw his hands up in the air and cut his staff. He went out and he looked for private philanthropists to put money into his school. He's working with the religious organizations. So he took a proactive step. And that we're lacking that. We're lacking ideas. And, you know, what I am proposing, it may not be the solution, but it gets the ball rolling and it helps to come up with something to supplement the cuts in funding, which people are just throwing their hands up in the air and then say, oh, well, Rick Perry this, Rick Perry that, rather than trying to find solutions to the problem. Now, we know that as a state senator, you don't necessarily have to work through the legislative process in order to get things done or changed. Because if we remember the last meal that was ordered for one death row inmate who didn't eat it, John Whitmire just complained about it and they stopped serving it. So it didn't require him to write a law to get it passed, to get it signed by the governor. He just threw his hands up in the air and complained about it and they stopped serving it. I've had the opportunity to lobby for the last two legislative sessions, and I've seen the influence that state elected officials have and the ability to connect the dots. And I believe that that is a way to supplement the funding. Now, as it relates to the curriculum, I think a 21st century education is one that incorporates science, technology, engineering, and math as a core curriculum for K-12, every school. Not Vanguard, not limited to Vanguard or magnet schools. And that is important because that is the future and it is the present. We look at China. China plans 100 years down the road. Now, their commodity is labor. That's why they produce things at a cheaper rate. But they are educating their kids for the future. And for some reason, Texas is not, would rather put more money in the criminal justice system than in the education system. A 21st century education also teaches our kids how to read so that they don't end up in prison. It teaches them financial management. It teaches them entrepreneur skills and how to manage a business, because that's part of being an American and being a Texan. So those are the things that I would do different in trying to overcome any issues as it relates to the legislative process, and then as it relates to the curriculum, because I took my car in once and it wasn't the engine. That was the problem, it was a computer chip. So people say we need more vocational training. Well, that vocational training, STEM still needs to be integrated into that vocational training, because the cars are run on technology now. And based on my research, even if you just have a high school diploma and you work in a STEM field, you're making $9 more an hour than the person, than your counterpart with a high school diploma. So it increases our standard of living, people are employed, and we have an education system that is more reflective of the times that we live in.
I mean, big debate in this past legislative session relating to education, once we get past the finance, has to do, though, with what the requirements are for graduation, both in terms of what courses kids are required to take and also in terms of what standardized tests they're required to pass. As you know, the legislature made some pretty significant changes in terms of what the graduation requirements are from high school. Big debate over whether or not Algebra 2 should be included. And also changed the number of end-of-course exams that students are required to take. What's your view of the changes that were made in this last legislative session? And, you know, where would you go from there?
I disagree with standardized tests as a measure of how a kid is doing. Only because one of the reasons why is because the schools start teaching to the test, and it hamstrings the teachers. They don't have the freedom to teach. They don't inspire their kids to learn, and it becomes more of a just something that they have to do rather than a labor of love. And so I'm not really supportive of standardized tests, because I think it takes away the freedom of the teachers and it doesn't assist kids in learning. As it relates to the coursework with a STEM program, I mean, you would have to take a lot of sciences, maths, because it's more than just having the latest technology in your classroom. It's knowing how to use it, knowing how to take it apart, put it together, building robots. And people always say, well, some kids don't have the aptitude for that, but kids don't have the aptitude for Shakespeare. They don't have the aptitude for math, whatever. We have to set high standards and high goals for our kids and ourselves. And so I believe that, you know, the coursework needs to be kind of elevated in terms of what they need to graduate. I don't know if you are, I dealt with Sharpstown High School and their graduation rate when they made all the misrepresentations. And what I saw were the administration and some folks more concerned about meeting those goals as opposed to getting those kids to graduate. And the bottom line is it's not really about teachers, the principals, or HISD. It's about educating these kids, getting them a good education so that they can contribute to our society and we keep our criminal justice system. And that's the most important thing. It boils down to what is in the best interest of the kids and how do we move the ball forward? How do we get away from becoming stagnant? How do we inspire our kids to want to achieve in life? And one thing that I have really taken a liking to is TED Talks, because they have different methods that discuss innovative ways of teaching kids or of implementing a particular curriculum that they have used successfully. And, you know, those are things that we need to try to adopt, some of that stuff.
Okay. You mentioned, and I agree with you, that we're probably going to be limited in terms of what funding mechanisms might be acceptable to your Republican counterparts in the Senate. But one funding mechanism that has been talked about for a long time is legalized gambling in Texas. You know, casinos, whatever else. This is something that comes up every session, never gets anywhere, but do you support, or what is your view on allowing an expansion of gambling in Texas, whether it's casinos, slot machines at racetracks, you know, allowing it on Indian land. What's your view?
You know, I have always, as long as I can remember, after getting the car, thought of ways to make Houston a better place, make Texas a better place. And I believe that legalizing gambling, whether it's destination places like Galveston, Corpus Christi, whatever, is something that should be passed. I don't think that that it hurts anybody. People that want to gamble are going to Louisiana. They just send the buses here. They gamble anyway. So if it's an issue as to whether or not it disproportionately affects people who don't have means, then, you know, I believe that argument fails because people are going to Louisiana, right across the border. Gambling can generate a whole bunch of revenue, additional revenue. Now, if this question is in connection with what do we do with the profits that we receive from gambling, do we invest in our education system? Now, so gambling should be legalized, not just on Indian reservations. And I think more of a destination place. I think that was discussed at one point, where you have it on the coastlines in Galveston. And that's one thing that I like about Tillman Fertitta. I think he is forward-thinking and forward-looking. And I like what he's done with Kima, and I like what he's doing with Galveston. And I think that would benefit our local economy in Houston. That would be generate more visitors to the city. And obviously it would generate more tax revenue. Now, how should that tax revenue be used? Well, obviously, if we're cutting funding for education, then I think that we ought to put that in education. But at the same time, the state rejects federal funds, right, that we're entitled to, that people complain about paying federal tax money, but when the federal government tries to give us our tax dollars back, they reject it. So, you know, it's almost a double-edged sword. It's almost like we're cutting funding while we're rejecting federal funds at the same time. So do we really have to cut funding? Do we really have to go into the rainy day fund if we would accept the federal funds, our own tax dollars, because we're contributing more to the federal government than what the state is accepting or rejecting for political reasons? So if it means to, if gambling is a tool to adequately fund and revolutionize our education system, then those tax dollars should be used for that. But I do believe in legalizing gambling. I don't see anything wrong with it.
Okay. Let's talk criminal justice, since you are talking about the size of Texas prison population. What steps, what specific things would you like to do as a state senator to help reduce the size of Texas prison population?
First of all, I believe that we take a proactive approach. We reform our education system so the kids are getting an education. They're in school. They're graduating. And they are employed. And they make a meaningful contribution to our economy. We support economic opportunities where people are employed. You know, Houston, I think, is projected to get an additional 500,000 jobs in the energy industry. I don't understand why, if we have vocational training, why didn't it target toward the energy industry? I mean, that's our bread and butter. Why is it just automotive? Why is it just something, you know, that you deal with your hands? Why aren't we looking at what drives our economy? What is fuel? Because we bring in a lot of people into the state from other parts of the country and the world to fill jobs and that we should be educating our kids to fill in our own hometown. So a proactive approach is reforming the education system, supporting some kind of economic opportunities, and not just the government doing all this stuff, but, you know, through private businesses and philanthropists, all that other stuff. And having somebody that is engaged and who can inspire kids to want to achieve in life. And that's what the district is lacking, somebody that can connect and relate to the kids that are the most vulnerable, the underprivileged kids. And one thing is also for black and Hispanic people to participate more in the jury process and to vote more, because we know that there's a disproportionate rate of blacks and Hispanics being arrested, prosecuted, and convicted. And if we had elected officials who were concerned about the judicial process, i.e. during the general election, they're out there campaigning to turn out the vote so that we have good judges elected rather than sitting back because they got theirs, then I think that would be a tool to help reform the criminal justice system at the initial level, where we have judges who aren't looking at these kids as if they're criminals because they can relate and understand where they're coming from. And then, you know, the communities that are most affected have a responsibility to participate in the process so they don't leave their life and liberty in the hands of folks that may perceive them as criminals.
Okay. You know, with the elections last year in, like, Washington and Colorado to change the state laws there on marijuana, there's been a lot of talk about reforming state laws elsewhere, including in Texas. That's part of a larger debate about the nature of, you know, the so-called war on drugs, which, of course, contributes greatly towards our prison population. What are your views on, you know, in particular, laws regarding drugs, controlled substances, and, you know, what changes? Do you support efforts to scale back or even decriminalize some of these things?
The war on drugs disproportionately affects blacks and Hispanics. So if a white kid is caught with marijuana, they're less likely to be arrested than if a black or Hispanic kid is. Okay? So
And then, obviously, they're going to be prosecuted and incarcerated for these nonviolent crimes, which is a consequence of laws that John Whitmire had written when he became chairman of the Criminal Justice Committee. Now, you know, as it relates to marijuana, I don't see any... I'm not opposed to legalizing it. I think a lot of people claim that marijuana is a gateway drug and other drugs. But in my opinion, alcohol is a gateway drug because that's the first thing that people indulge in because it's legal to get the buzz or the high. And that's what leads them to want to try other things. So, you know, if we were to be sincere and genuine and real with the issue, we would say, okay, you know, alcohol... It changes people's behavior in a bad way, and it can result in some kind of accident, you know, with on the road. Those things are common issues with alcohol. Marijuana, I don't know anybody to want to go out and kill somebody who smoked marijuana, or to beat up their wife, or to overdose, or to you know, get into some kind of accident where they kill somebody. I'm not saying that that's not possible, but I think that, you know, if there is a way to bring in tax revenue, reduce the crime rate, reduce, you know, the across-the-border rate of incidents of trying to import this stuff, then we ought to consider it. I don't see anything wrong with legalizing marijuana.
Okay.
And taxing it and getting money off of it.
Okay. Along similar lines, I mean, this past year, nationally, there's been a large discussion about privacy and the overreach, or the overreach of criminal justice and other agencies into people's daily lives in terms of surveillance, with increased computing power, with the persistence of information on the internet, you know, with security cameras all over the place. You know, we're all being, you know, observed and recorded a lot more. You know, government agencies, law enforcement agencies know a lot more, have access to a lot more information about us that they don't necessarily need to get permission to access. There's talk about, you know, one of the technologies that law enforcement agencies are starting to use includes drones, unmanned, you know, surveillance machines that, you know, that are currently unregulated. What's your view, you can be as general or specific as you want, on the prevalence of technology in law enforcement and the ability of law enforcement to monitor the citizenry without, you know, without warrants? Where do you see the need to do something about this legislatively?
I am a firm believer in privacy. I mean, that is something that is one of the core beliefs that I hold, to the point to where I limit my use of wireless internet, because I believe people are entitled to have some level of privacy. Obviously, that is a guarantee under our Constitution. I think it is intrusive to use drones. I think it's intrusive to use facial recognition software if you're walking down the street. I believe it's an invasion of privacy. And quite honest with you, I haven't given it any consideration as it relates to legislating it. But to the extent that it is unregulated, that would be something I would like to see more regulated. People have a tendency to abuse power, and they may start off in a good way, but they may find that they have an opponent in the primary, or they may dislike somebody down the street, and they may use their access to certain things to their advantage or to hurt that other person. And I think that, you know, if you're going around with unmanned drones following just regular Texans on the street trying to listen to their conversation,
I think that that is a problem, because I believe people have a fundamental right to privacy. Fundamental. Unwavering. And that includes whether you are in the doctor's office. I don't believe the government should be in the doctor's office with you, telling your doctor what they should do to you. Okay? Just like I don't believe that they should be in your bedroom, because that is your business. That's your private business. And I'm a firm believer in a person's right to privacy.
Okay, well, that obviously ties into the big debates that went on in the legislature this past year regarding women's health care and abortion. And let's tell me where you stand on abortion, on the limits that the Texas has put on access to birth control and women's health care.
I think a woman should have the right to choose. We don't know the situation that they're in. We don't know what has led them to make the decision that they are choosing to make, whether they decide to keep, to follow through with the pregnancy or to abort it, or whether they decide to keep their child or to put them up for adoption. And what I have seen is that the people that are legislating this stuff have dealt with this issue firsthand in their personal life. And, you know, the person has to live with that, that makes that decision if they want to have an abortion or put the kid up for adoption or have a baby. So I believe a woman should have the right to choose. I believe that it is just, it's like, as a society, we are regressing. We're going backwards in time. We're limiting a person's right to vote. We are limiting a woman's right to choose. We've had the same people up there for 40 years. I think that now is the time for the next generation to participate in shaping our future. Because in order for us to carry the advances of the prior generation, it takes the next generation to take that legacy to the next level. And at this point, we are regressing. I think what Texas is doing and what these other states are doing are just, number one, it's unconstitutional. Okay, again, you have a right to privacy, and these are the same people who are complaining about the government and in their business, but yet they want to put the state of government in somebody's doctor's office with them. They want to control whether a doctor can perform an abortion so that they can limit the number of clinics that are available. And then when these kids are born, they want to complain that these women are having all these kids, and they don't want to take care of them. So they don't want you to, they don't want you to have an abortion, but then they don't want to assist them when they're here. And that's one thing, and I try to pride myself on, is I try to limit and eliminate my level of hypocrisy. And I just find it very hypocritical of someone to be an advocate for the unborn, but yet when they come here, they despise them and they don't want to assist them. So I think that is a problem that we have with our state government and with a lot of state governments throughout the country that are controlled by Republicans.
Okay. Something I'm going to be asking every Democrat I talk to, I hope, in one of these interviews. What are you doing? What are you doing now? What will you be doing over the next 11 months to help Wendy Davis, Letitia Vanderput, and other statewide Democrats get elected?
You know,
when I win, it will be, let me go back. If we look at, as a Democrat, if we look at who is exciting the Democratic Party base, it's the Castro brothers in San Antonio, Wendy Davis. It's the future of the Democratic Party, not the past, not John Whitmire, not these other folks who are supporting him. It's the future. And when I win this race in March, I don't believe that it would just be a local story or a state story. I think it would be a national story, because the national media is looking for signs. They want Texas to turn blue. At least MSNBC does. Rachel Maddow, who is very, very intelligent. So they're looking for signs to see if this state is going to turn blue. And they are jumping on any sign that they can get. And that would be a sign that Texas is turning blue.
And I believe that Wendy Davis has a better chance of winning when I win. Because as the executive director of the State Democratic Party put it, Will Hale, they did a profile on me. They asked me to run for the Texas Supreme Court. Thought I'd be a great statewide candidate. I could bring more voters out. I have a diverse appeal, all this other stuff. I believe that we could turn Harris County blue. You have somebody with energy, somebody who's proactive, somebody that as a, you know what else I learned as a judicial candidate? I learned how difficult it is for a judicial candidate to turn out the votes. I learned how important it is for these elected officials to participate more in the general election, to put their name, their reputation, their money behind turning out the votes. And that's what we are lacking. See, when people are in office for 20, 30, 40 years, they don't care. But when you have experienced that and you saw what was needed to get these people over the hump so that they can have more name recognition so that people will know to vote down a long ballot, being more active and campaigning for these candidates in the general election, making sure Senate District 15 is blue, putting precinct chairs in all those precincts. See, when I was looking at this, I think there are 227 precincts, they may have had 90, maybe 100 precinct chairs. As a state senator, I would make sure that they would have 227 precinct chairs, because I believe that is essential in turning out the vote and turning Harris County blue. I think that Wendy Davis has a better chance of winning when I win, and I will definitely campaign for her and make sure that Senate District 15 is a blue district.
Okay. And just to wrap this all up, why should people vote for you in this primary election? You are, as you've repeatedly said, running against a long-tenured incumbent. Mm-hmm. And seniority does matter in the Senate. It matters in the House, too. But it does. It's not nothing. It does matter. Why should voters in the Democratic primary vote to put you in as a freshman in place of a long-standing incumbent?
First of all, seniority only matters if it benefits people in the district. So if it's only benefiting one person, then it really doesn't matter. Now, it matters to John Whitmire because he's a professional politician and he wants to continue to be a state senator for the rest of his life. But for the people who live in Senate District 15, they haven't benefited from his seniority. This man has not been in the district hands-on for over 20 years. When I went around the district to determine whether or not I was going to run, the first question I would ask people was, who is your state senator? They didn't know. They thought it was Sheila Jackson Lee, Rodney Ellis, Sylvester Turner. So being there for 40 years really, or having that seniority really is meaningless if it doesn't benefit the people for which you are privileged to serve. Second thing, accessibility. If you're going to be a state senator, I think Sylvia Garcia has 3 district offices. Rodney Ellis has 3 district offices because these districts are big so that they could be accessible to their constituents. Whitmire has 1. Okay, he's been there 40 years. At some point, people get complacent. They lose sight of what's important to the people in their district, and it requires some new ideas and some new blood to get things moving. Now, at some point, John Whitmire will not be in that seat, whether he dies or on March 4th. So that seniority will be lost at some point. And now is the time. It can be a better time. Now, as it relates to why they should vote for me, you have somebody that is proactive, who identifies a problem and tries to solve it, okay?
And whether I have the best ideas or answer a solution to that, it may not be the case. But at least, you know, I am looking at solutions to the problems, and I'm not just saying this person is doing this and throwing my hands in the air. You have somebody that sees a need to reform our education system and sees that as an essential part of reforming the criminal justice systems. See, for black and brown kids, once they get that number, it's over for them. It's difficult for them to get a job. So if you're reforming it on the back end, it's too late for them. That's reactive. Somebody needs to be proactive to keep them out of jail, and we need to think of solutions to that. And that includes opening more community centers for kids to go to after school rather than hanging out on the block, which used to be around, at least when I was growing up. Somebody that's engaged and active, who goes around the district to understand what the issues are that the people have. Like I said, this is a diverse district, very diverse. It goes from Montrose, you know, through the Heights, as you know, Acres Homes, Northwest Houston, Baytown, Humble, Atascocita, Intercontinental Airport. It's a big district, Spring Branch. It's a very diverse district. So you need somebody out there that is going to engage the constituents that they represent to understand the issues that they face, to try to help them resolve them to the best that you can. And, you know, this election boils down, you know, the voters haven't had a choice for state senator for 22 years. He's run unopposed for 22 years. To me, that's not a democracy. And, you know, to just rubber stamp an incumbent is to abdicate anybody's responsibility as a voter. Just because they've been there doesn't mean that they deserve to be there or that they're entitled to that office. You know, with John Whitmire, if you like him, that's good, like him. But it's okay to say thank you for your service. We appreciate it. You've been there for 40 years. Now we want to turn a page and go in a different direction. You don't have to be held hostage to an incumbent just because they're there. And that's what people tend to fall back on. And really, it deprives them of chance to move forward. And personally, I believe every incumbent should be opposed in the primary, because the primaries are where these elections are won. Because the districts are gerrymandered. It's either going to be a Republican or a Democrat that wins based on how the district is drawn up. And, you know, unfortunately for John Whitmire, he's trying to get active now. But, you know, it took somebody to run against him for him to do his job. How many of us get the opportunity to sit around for 40 years on our job and our boss tells us, okay, if you don't do your job, I'm going to replace you? Nobody gets that opportunity. And he's had his time. He's been there since he was 23 years old. He's about to collect Social Security. No offense, I'm just saying, I mean, we have a generation of ideas that are going to be skipped over, a generation who's grown up during a different time period, have different life experiences, different ideas on how to solve our problems, that get skipped over because somebody believes that they're entitled to a seat. So basically, the voters have a choice that they haven't had in 22 years. They can vote to add 4 more years to 40 years of history by voting for John Whitmire, or they can vote for the future by voting for me. And by voting for the future, they get a better chance of turning Texas blue, Harris County blue, and Wendy Davis winning.
All right. Damon LaCroix, thank you very much for talking.